The Guardian.
I'm Anoushka Astana and I'm bringing you Politics Weekly from the Houses of Parliament, where there is quite a buzz. MPs returning, looking a little dazed after that election result.
We have been projecting a hung parliament all evening. Now we can say with certainty we were right. The exit poll was more or less right.
Theresa May did not get a majority, so she's seeking the help of the DUP. And in the meantime, has been to Paris to meet French President Emmanuel Macron, who excited Remainers everywhere with this.
La porte est évidemment toujours ouverte.
In English, that's the EU door is still open to the UK, although not for long. However, it is certainly true that a minority government means new parliamentary mathematics, with a majority in this House now backing a so-called soft Brexit. But what does that even mean? We'll be talking to Tory politicians on either side of the Brexit divide, Neil Carmichael and James Cleverly, and asking Labour's Yvette Cooper about her ideas for a cross-party Brexit commission. We'll also be talking to The Guardian's very own sketchwriter John Crace, who deserves some praise for inventing the term Maybot. But first, let's go find a man who I think is probably emboldened by the election result, Labour's shadow Brexit secretary, Keir Starmer. You have stripped Theresa May of her majority in favour of a hard Brexit. What does Labour say now?
We have four demands. First, the tone and approach has to change. We need to make it clear that we will no longer be members of the EU, but we want to be partners. And so the tone and approach has to be one of collaboration and cooperation. Secondly, there has to be a much higher emphasis on the benefits of the customs union and the single market, because jobs and the economy have to come first. Thirdly, Theresa May and the government have to drop the idea that no deal is a viable option. No deal is a very bad deal. It's where you end up when you're pushed off the cliff at the end of 2 years. And fourth demand we've got is that there must be much more involvement of Parliament in the process.
And how do you force that onto their agenda? Do you talk continuously with other opposition parties, but also Tory MPs?
We talk to all political parties, and I'll be writing to David Davis to make those demands.
Keir, it's been a difficult process coming up with a position for the Labour Party. You decided to back Article 50. You yourself represent a constituency that was overwhelmingly Remain. That was a pretty difficult thing for you to do.
It was difficult. We had to recognise that we respected the result of the referendum, but also that we wanted a new partnership with the EU. So we said not membership, but partnership based on collaboration and cooperation. But it was not easy. And we needed something which was legally coherent, but also politically astute, because we had members, MPs, voters and supporters in both camps. And many people were urging us to go either with the 48% or the 52%. And we said, no, we want to go for the 100%, at which point everybody said, well, it's not the 100% you'll get, it's the 0%. And therefore, to that extent, I think, we're entitled to feel that we got it about right, given the results that we've now had. And in my constituency, which was 75% for remaining in the EU, in the end, I got 70% of the vote last week.
But in the end, you can't please, can you, the voters of Wakefield in quite the same way as the voters of Hackney when we come to an eventual deal?
Hartlepool and Holborn might be my comparators. Hartlepool, I think, voted pretty overwhelmingly to leave, and Holborn, my constituency, overwhelmingly to remain. And we needed to get something politically astute that allowed us to speak to both of those constituencies. Now, we need to do the deeper analysis, but I think that the position we adopted on Brexit allowed us to do that successfully.
And one of the big risks was losing those working class voters in the north who had backed Brexit. A lot of people thought that, Theresa May in fact, thought that a lot of those seats were going to swing to the Conservatives. They didn't in the end. Now, part of that's probably to do with Jeremy Corbyn, and I'd like you to comment on that. But surely part of it is a disastrous campaign by the Tories.
Well, the Tory campaign was disastrous. It was a disastrous campaign that ran alongside a positive message of hope from the Labour Party and a manifesto that really spoke to people about transforming society for the future. And Jeremy drove that with energy and commitment, and he should take the credit for it.
Were you quite surprised and impressed?
I went into the election on the defensive, and I came out very pleasantly surprised. It got more positive as it went along, certainly in the last 2 weeks, but I'm not going to pretend that I foresaw the outcome.
The Prime Minister has been branded the Maybot because of her quite unfriendly, sometimes quite harsh nature. Do you think that that has to go in Brexit negotiations?
Well, the approach she's taken in the Brexit negotiations is an extreme position of sort of sweeping options off the table, being belligerent and not indicating to our EU partners that we want a future relationship based on cooperation and collaboration. Now, that's not just Theresa May. That's been the government's position. So she needs to change her tone and approach for sure, but the government needs to change its tone and approach as well.
Do you think it's more in the national interest for the UK and Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn, whoever's the Prime Minister, to be closer to Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel, etc., than it is to perhaps cozy up to Donald Trump?
I think the relationship we have with the EU is of real importance, and we need to focus on getting that relationship absolutely right, because that's the one we're negotiating.
More so than our relations with America?
Well, our relations with America are really important, but at the moment, what is paramount is negotiating the right deal with the EU.
That was Keir Starmer, now back in a busy Portcullis House in Parliament to speak to Neil Carmichael, a Tory who lost his seat in Stroud and who is a passionate advocate for soft Brexit, and James Cleverly, who campaigned to leave the EU and is part of the European Research Group, Tory backbenchers who want to get on with the job. Neil, do you think that Brexit had anything to do with your result?
Not really, because what I noticed was that even though I was well known as a Remainer, it didn't seem to have any impact on people's decision to vote for me in the context of Brexit.
And what do you then think happened?
I think what happened was that we had an appallingly prepared manifesto with policies which were half-baked, which demonstrated that we hadn't really got a vision for the future. We weren't positive, and we sort of basically ran into the problem of being blamed for austerity without any answer. And we also had the technical problem in terms of electioneering that we did not reach out to the young people as well as the Labour Party.
And on that austerity point, James, a lot of your colleagues have talked about the fact that public sector workers particularly seemed unwilling to vote Conservative. Is there going to be a move towards more of an anti-austerity position now from the Tories, or do you just need to have a better answer on austerity?
Well, I don't think we can completely disregard the fact that the public finances are still in a difficult place. But I think Neil's absolutely spot on, because, I mean, I went to vote and I bumped into a young woman coming out of the polling station, and I said, oh, have you just voted? And she smiled and went, yes. And then she looked a little bit sheepish. And I said, you didn't vote for me, did you? And her reply, she just went, see, I'm a nurse. And in her mind, that was all she needed to say. And I think when it gets to the stage where it becomes almost, certainly in her mind, inconceivable for a public sector professional to vote Conservative, we have got to address that. We have really got to look at that. So we can't magic money out of nowhere. We've made that clear. But I do think we need to look seriously at the impact that the decisions we've made have had over now best part of a decade on the people who work in the public sector.
I'd really like to ask you whether you think that this changes things in terms of Brexit. Theresa May, very clear, I need a mandate for my vision of Brexit. She didn't get that mandate, did she?
Well, again, I'm going to agree with Neil on this one. Brexit was the dog that didn't bark at this election. There were all kinds of issues that came up. We were trying to push the Brexit as being a really important issue, but just it didn't stick. It didn't stick with the voters. The concerns about austerity, that stuck with the voters. I think the missteps that we had during the campaign over adult social care and the impact of a lot of our other policies, those things stuck, but Brexit just didn't stick. And therefore, I'm not sure we can read too much into the result in terms of what the public mood is about Brexit, because we're getting such massively contradictory messages from different parts of the country.
OK, and whatever the public think, the parliamentary mathematics has changed. Cabinet ministers are very open about that. We now have a majority for what you might call a soft Brexit. Neil, what is a soft Brexit?
Well, first of all, what I'd like to say is, although Brexit didn't actually really dominate in the election, the actual outcome has opened up the Brexit debate, because we are now talking about the difference between a hard Brexit and a soft Brexit. We are actually thinking that we're going to get some kind of a compromise, and we're seeing people like David Cameron pointing out that we've got to reach out to other political parties to get anything done. So that is a seismic change from the situation before the election, and I think it's a welcome one from the point of view of those who want a soft Brexit. What is a soft Brexit? Well, I think there are sort of three things we've got to make sure we do. One is make it obvious that we want to have good relationships with the European Union and the EU27 so that we can actually broker deals in the future which matter to us and matter to them. The second thing is this question about trade. I think we do need to have access to the single market, and we're going to see just how complicated this is going to be precisely because of another aspect of this election, which is the DUP's role. Because you'll see, I think, that the position of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic becomes a kind of lightning conductor for all of the concerns about the single market. And then the third thing we need to be thinking about are the supply chains, which will be broken if we do not act sensibly over the final deal and transitional arrangements. We're already seeing the impact of sort of the sense that, oh, it's all going to go wrong with the behaviour of some businesses in connection with supply chains, and we've got to stop that.
And in terms of the differences on this, Philip Hammond, some newspapers are suggesting will want us to remain inside the customs union. That would, of course, limit our ability to build new trade deals. Is that a red line for people like yourselves, James?
Well, the funny thing is, Neil's just described what he views as a soft Brexit. I'm more of a kind of a tooth and claw Brexiteer, but I find myself not massively at odds with a lot of things he's just said, and I think this is where the potential success lies, because the things that Neil's highlighted as being important, which is our ability to remain cordial with our European partners, is really important. Our ability to maximise our trade with the EU, now whether that is, I don't think we can do that formally within the single market, but replicating as much of the single market as possible so we can have as free a trade as possible, I think is really important. And I think the customs union and therefore the Northern Ireland Republic of Ireland border, now that is a really, really important one, because I think our future success is heavily reliant on our ability to sign free trade deals with the rest of the world. But if we can synthesise a lot of the benefits of membership of the customs union, see, I think that's where we are. And I think there's less polarisation in the language, because increasingly what people who have been talking about soft Brexit, hard Brexit, when you actually, wipe away that rhetorical level, we're not looking at things that are so very, very far apart. And I think that's where success could sit.
Okay, but let me just highlight a couple of places where I suspect you two may be slightly apart. For example, the level of access you get to the single market may depend on the level of restrictions that you want to place on immigration, A, and the level of access you get to the customs union will clearly restrict your ability to make trade deals abroad. Neil, on those two points, do you think the Conservatives need to soften their position?
I certainly think we need to soften our position in terms of migration, because my select committee, when I was still chair, did a report on the issue of universities, higher education, and we pointed out that lots of damage would be done if we didn't have a proper approach to ensuring that students could come here and staff and so on could as well. That applies to business as well. If you've got Airbus, for example, which is a huge company, wanting to transfer people internal to the company and then find that they're external to movement of labour area, well, that's not going to be very helpful. And we need to consider the consequences of that. This question of trade, there are two things about it which really have got to be hammered home. One is that if we end up with a WTO situation, World Trade Organization rule system, many people say, oh, well, that'll just mean tariffs. Well, it will, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is that we will be worrying about trade defense, and we'll be worrying about aspects of regulation and protectionism. And, Pascal Lamy, when he came over here some weeks ago, made those points very forcibly, and he's absolutely right. If anybody actually thinks about trade, you've got to remember that it is about the capacity of other nation states to leverage their advantage against ours, and they will use those opportunities where appropriate. The other thing about trade, which is not properly discussed, is that through the European Union, we already have free trade deals with most of the places we need to have free trade deals. And the problem with that is that we need to get better at trading. China, for example. Germany actually exports almost four times as much to the Chinese economy than we do. But we're both in the European Union, so how can that variance be as great as it is?
Okay, well, we have a point of disagreement. James, you're shaking your head. You don't want to stay in the EU trade bloc, if you like, and do those deals as a group?
Well, actually, one of the reasons why I was passionate about leaving the European Union is because it has an abysmal reputation for signing international trade deals. It has lots of trade deals, but if you look down the list of countries, most of them are economic minnows. The vast bulk of the European trade, which is facilitated by trade deals, is with a trade deal with Switzerland and a trade deal with South Korea. The EU does not have a trade deal with Canada, with the United States of America, with China, with India, with Canada, with New Zealand, with South Africa, with Brazil. There are massive gaps where our trade potential could sit.
Do you agree that the parliamentary mathematics may be hard on some points? Is it, for example, time to drop the tens of thousands target on immigration?
Well, you know, you've got to deal with the hand that you're dealt at the election. Now, you know, every single Labour member of Parliament, every single Conservative member of Parliament was elected in on a manifesto which said we were going to leave the single market and have greater control over immigration. Exactly what that greater control means is obviously going to have to be discussed, because we don't have the opportunity to say, well, it was in our manifesto and therefore that's all that matters.
Neil, you won't be here. It's frustrating, I know. Just tell us, in response to what James said and to finish us off, what you'll be doing and how you'll be doing it.
Well, I just wanted to say, although I'm not a member of Parliament for the immediate future, I fully intend to be fully active and making sure that the cases I've just been making today is advanced properly wherever appropriate, because I'm not giving up on these issues and I will keep being involved.
Great. Well, I think there's increasing agreement between the Brexiteers on one side of the argument and the soft Brexiteers on the other, but it's very clear we're going to have lots of debates in this Parliament. Thank you both. Now, off to find senior Labour MP Yvette Cooper to talk about her ideas on how to work cross-party when it comes to Brexit. One of the extraordinary things is that Theresa May went to the country, essentially asked for a mandate for her vision of Brexit. And she has come back to a parliament where the numbers add up very, very differently. What does that mean for you and for the future of the Brexit process?
I think it wasn't just about a mandate for a vision, because actually her vision's never been very clear. It was also about she was asking for a mandate for a way of doing things, which was a very secretive way of doing things, very much doing this through a Tory cabal. And she didn't get that. And I think people across the country, whether they voted Leave or Remain, said, actually, no, we don't think that Theresa May is the right person to definitely get us the best deal. So I had people I talked to in Yorkshire would say, actually, we're not sure she's going to get us the best deal in Yorkshire. We're not sure she's going to take account of what we need for Yorkshire manufacturing and so on. So I think, look, overall, Theresa May can't just behave as if the election didn't happen. She can't just carry on trying to do things in a narrow Conservative Party way through a very small people being involved in it. I don't think it was actually ever the right thing to do. When you've got something that is so important as this, something that is going to have repercussions for generations, you ought to do this on a cross-party basis. You ought to do this on a broad way that try and build consensus. And she was never doing that. There's even more reason for her to do that now.
But the Labour Party itself, the leadership of the Labour Party, finds it very hard, the idea of working with the Conservatives. A large part of your vote was arguably an anti-Tory vote. I don't see the leadership reaching over. So how does it work then?
It certainly was an anti-Tory vote, and there will continue to be strong disagreements between us and strong rows about things like the school cuts, about the state of the National Health Service, about a whole series of different things. But in the end, when it comes to the Brexit negotiations, there ought to be some common ground between all parties, and it's on that common ground that we ought to try and get the best deal. Because otherwise, all that will happen is, a couple of years later, it'll unravel because somebody will say, oh, they want a different kind of deal, or they want something else, and this will just carry on being unresolved. We have to have something that is sustainable for generations to come, and the only way to do that is to get lots of different people and lots of different voices involved and accept that everybody's going to have to compromise on this. There's a lot of stuff we won't compromise on, or we won't compromise on opposing school cuts. We won't compromise on a whole series of things, damaging things the Tories are doing, which we will fight all the way. But there are some things where everybody is going to have to just compromise a bit and work together to get the best deal.
And although the Tories might drop a lot of their domestic agenda, essentially they're going to have to get at least 7 bills through Parliament that are linked to Brexit on things like immigration, the single market, customs union. Just explain to some of our listeners how hard that might be, given the parliamentary mathematics. You know, one or two or three MPs causing trouble or not turning up, being ill, whatever it is, could actually cause quite a big difference.
Well, they've got a lot of legislation to get through, and every vote will count. We know that there'll be some days actually when the DUP won't be there, or when they won't agree with the Tories on particular issues, and where there may be, you know, other members of the Tory party who rightly think that actually what the government's putting forward is wrong, and they have a responsibility, a national responsibility, a national interest to vote against it. And we will certainly need to be there pointing that out and highlighting all of those kind of serious issues with long-term consequences. So in the end, look, it's not even actually just about whether or not they can get it through a week on Thursday or in 2 months' time or next November. It's also about whether they can come up with something that you won't then have huge pressure to just reverse or unravel or do something different in 2 years' time. When you've got something like this, which in the end has constitutional implications, you should try and do it on a cross-party basis so that it lasts.
And before the election, there were a few sort of Remainer Tories, if you like, people pushing for a so-called soft Brexit, who got shouted down quite quickly when they came out, and perhaps people were a bit nervous about putting their head above the parapet. Does this election totally change that? Do those people feel emboldened?
I think a lot of people in the Tory party, and certainly some of the Tory MPs that I've spoken to, are just really shaking their heads about why on earth this election was called in the first place, and about the consequences of it now, where you can't just pretend the election didn't happen. You can't just pretend that you've got far more votes and far more MPs than you have. And you've got to work with other people. If a hung parliament is what people across the country have voted for, that means in Parliament, politicians, MPs, we've got to work with that and say we respect the decision that the electorate have made. And especially on something like Brexit, you know, that means there is a responsibility on the Tory party to work in a different way, to open up. I think they should set up a cross-party commission to do this rather than just trying to do it all themselves.
And have you had any response to that suggestion?
Well, we've been talking to MPs of different parties about how it might work, about different ways of doing it. And look, there are clearly different views about how you could do it. There's a lot of different ways that you could do it. But the point is to get people from all sorts of different parties, all kinds of different views, to actually have their say and to come up with something that, you know, will be a compromise, but to work together to do it. So there's a lot of interest from all sides in finding a way to do this.
And just finally, you talked about Tory MPs walking around shaking their heads about the election. There are a few Labour MPs who a lot of us expected not to be here. I think they didn't expect to be here. Maybe people representing Chester, Halifax, places like Wakefield. Tell us how it feels and what happened.
Well, it's great to see more Labour MPs in Parliament. I mean, you know, obviously we want to go further and we want to get a Labour government elected, but to see more new MPs walking around Parliament is brilliant. And obviously, as well, particularly the increase in the youth vote was really good for us and really important for Labour in this election, but I also think it is good for democracy, and so we should all be pleased at what happened there.
That was Evette Cooper. Let's go and try and talk to The Guardian's sketch writer, John Crace. So during the election campaign, John and I were on a train going off to some speech or the other when a woman on the train stopped dead in her tracks and suddenly looked at him and said, John Crace, my hero. It was a real moment. And in fact, John, you are now my hero because you invented the Maybot. The Maybot, which today is on the front page of The Spectator, with people saying that the Maybot is cranking back into life. Tell us about your latest column where you mentioned that she could be reprogrammed.
Well, I mean, when she came out after losing the election, it was like she was sort of Maybot 1.0, which was sort of still strong and stable, and the election hadn't really happened. But somebody over the weekend has reminded her that she didn't do particularly well. So there is a slight hint of contrition now. but it's more strong and humble, which is stumble, as far as I can see. Because she was saying in her speech yesterday, some people blame politics for the divisions in the country. This from a woman who ran the most divisive election campaign in history.
And you say it was divisive, but during it all, you came up with this idea that she was basically the Maybot. Tell us about it.
Well, actually, I came up with the idea last November because I was sketching an interview she did with Sky when she was in India for the trade talks. And it was just one of those typical interviews where she said absolutely nothing. And it really was like a sort of zombie android speaking. There was no attempt to engage with the question. I mean, we know that politicians often go out of their way not to answer questions, but this was sort of... this was sort of so monotonal, it was worth an incarnation of the Maybot.
Now, everyone's talking about whether she can be a bit more human, but also recently with you, after that dreadful election result for her, we stood outside a meeting of all her party's MPs. They were ready to bring her down. And some of them coming out, one was actually in tears, saying, "We've got our leader back. The Maybot has gone." Now, I know you say that there's a bit of a stumble about it, but do you accept that perhaps we are seeing a warmer side of her?
I'm yet to be convinced by that, to be honest. I mean, my feeling from the 1922 committee was that all the MPs had looked around the room and saw that there was actually no other option. It was sort of either Boris or Jeremy Corbyn. That's what was on offer. And put against that, then it was sort of rally round Theresa time. So in a sense, her humiliation became their humiliation.
John Crace, thank you so much for being with us. Well, that's all we've got time for after this momentous week in British politics. I'm Anushka Astana. The producer was Gabriella Jones. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.